Welcome to the Divorce Hour with Alyssa Panitz. We want to support and comfort anyone going through this painful journey and be the guiding light so many people are looking for.
Everyone has a story, and when it comes to divorce, plenty of people will tell you they can write a book about what they experience. For some, divorce can be a turning point, a chance to reinvent yourself, start a new career, or take all that energy and channel it into something completely different. What you do with your story, well, that's up to you. But if you decide to rebrand yourself after divorce, do it for the right reasons and choose your words carefully. And that's a phrase we say a lot here at the Divorce Hour. Now, remember the Olympic swimmer, Ryan Lochte? Well, he was married to a model named Kayla Reed for about a decade and they share three children together. In March of 2025, Kayla filed for divorce and now she's talking to People magazine about her life as a Florida real estate agent, co-host of the podcast, The Comeback Era, and something much more personal, her relationship with her famous ex-husband and how they are handling parenting their children from different states, since Ryan resides in Missouri, where he now works as a swim coach. Kayla told People that she considers herself the head parent in charge and said that rather co-parenting with Ryan, they practice what is known as parallel parenting, where each parent runs their own household their own way and parents the children their own way. According to the Center for Divorce Education, parallel parenting is more common in high-conflict divorces if traditional co-parenting is just too difficult. Kayla, who also documents her life on social media, also reveals her financial situation and what Ryan does and doesn't do to support the kids. And this brings up an important FYI. Just because everyone has the right to tell their story doesn't mean every detail needs to be shared publicly. For instance, experts say revealing private financial information or taking shots at the other side could ultimately hurt the children. Experts often recommend that divorced parents should establish clear boundaries about what is appropriate to discuss and what should remain behind closed doors. Also, if the children start asking a lot of questions, experts say you can state facts without insulting the other side. For example, instead of saying mommy and daddy can't afford to do things we used to do because daddy isn't doing his part, you can say, mommy and daddy changed jobs, so we may have to choose two activities instead of doing five. Same situation, very different message. Because at the end of the day, the goal is to love your children and let them have their own relationships with each of you and you support what they want. Don't go anywhere because we will be right back with our first guest after this commercial break. So, stick around. When Jeff and Mackenzie Bezos finalized their divorce in 2019, there was $150 billion in wealth on the table. In 2021, Bill and Melinda Gates announced their divorce. $146 billion in combined wealth was at stake. And in 2026, another ultra-high net worth divorce is making headlines. New Jersey hedge fund billionaire John Overlook and his wife, Laura, are in the middle of a divorce. And according to published reports, his company, Two Sigma, has been valued at around $80 billion. The couple have been married for 24 years, have something in common with Gates and Bezos. No one had a prenup. Now, what happens when couples of this kind of wealth decide to call it quits? And how does the law deal with these assets? Well, joining us to break it all down is Anthony Diaz, founder of the law firm of Anthony Diaz. Anthony's a trained litigator, certified in mediation, collaborative law, and he's known to many as the peacemaker. Anthony, welcome.
It's great to be here, Alyssa, and I can't wait to dive into this loaded topic.
No pun intended. And let's start with the amount of money involved. New Jersey hedge fund king John Overlook is reportedly worth more than $8 billion. Now, he and his wife, Laura, have been married for 24 years without a prenuptial agreement. When a divorce involving billions of dollars is unfolding in an equitable distribution state, and New Jersey is an equitable distribution state, does the basic concept of equitable distribution still apply in the same way? Or does the size and complexity of the case change and how the court approaches matters such as these?
Yeah, so a couple of things. You know, the fundamental legal framework doesn't change of equitable distribution simply because the marital estate is worth billions of dollars. It doesn't matter whether it's billions or thousands of dollars. I don't know New Jersey law, so I'm going to talk about Florida law and just in general how courts look at these. So, like in Florida, what a court does, first they look at what assets and liabilities are marital and what are non-marital. And because the marital assets are the ones that have to be distributed, the non-marital assets get kind of put to the side. It's not part of the calculation. Then what it does, it has to value the marital assets, and then it starts out with an equal distribution mindset. And just so everybody knows, you know, a court can make an unequal distribution when the law states that it can, and there are factors that will allow for that. So what changes in a case of this magnitude is not the basic law, but just how complex it is to apply it. So if this were a Florida case, a couple of questions would be, okay, was the ownership interest in anything that's being looked at, was it acquired before or during the marriage? If it's before, it's non-marital. If it's during, it's marital. So we get that out of the way. What happens if his company existed before the marriage? You know, how much was it worth on the wedding date? Because, you know, that amount is going to be excluded, and we just need to look at how much it was worth between the date of marriage and the date of filing. Then what a court has to do is, okay, now that we have that increase, how much of that happened during the marriage, which is a result of just the market, the way it works, or how much of it resulted from the owner's spouse's marital labor and effort? And that's a complicated theory, but the court has to look at, did the spouse increase that value from their own work, or did it just increase on its own? So, you know, these are a number of things the court looks at. The court's also going to look at the length of marriage. A 24-year marriage is highly significant. And Florida looks at not only the financial, but non-financial contributions, like raising children, maintaining the household, and supporting the other spouse's ability to build a business. So all of these questions and calculations take place when you have a marital estate that is the size of this one.
According to published reports, Laura has reportedly been barred from testifying in court after the judge learned of allegations where Laura allegedly used illegal tactics, such as hacking into her husband's computer, deleting correspondence between he and his attorneys. She also gained access to his private PO mailbox. If a judge determines that one side improperly accesses confidential information or interferes with the legal process, can that misconduct affect the financial outcome of a divorce?
Well, it's unfortunate that, you know, some devious things happened, and courts don't like when people do things that they're not supposed to or they act bad. So, you know, we need to distinguish between the division of marital property and the sanctions for any misconduct. So, like in Florida, is a no-fault divorce state. So a court doesn't ordinarily redistribute marital wealth simply to punish someone for behaving badly. The equitable distribution is not intended to become a penalty system for marital misconduct. However, misconduct can have serious financial consequences when it affects the value of the marital assets or the availability of it, the integrity of discovery, the preservation of evidence. If attorney-client privilege was, you know, was abused. So if a party improperly accesses privileged communications, deletes evidence, violates discovery obligations, a Florida court may impose sanctions proportionate to the conduct. What could that be? The court can exclude any evidence that was improperly obtained. It could also award attorney's fees and forensic expenses to the harmed party, and that could be significant. It could limit or exclude the testimony that has to do with this this information that was improperly gotten. And in an extreme case, it wouldn't happen in this case, but in some cases, the court can dismiss or default the case and award everything to the other party if if that's the sanction that works. So the court has mechanisms to impose sanctions, and especially if that conduct had to do with hiding assets or depleting assets, then a court can have an unequal distribution of wealth because of that.
If a couple has minor children and one parent is found guilty of these allegations such as the ones I just described, can that impact custody and parenting time when you're going into negotiations to finalize an agreement when it comes to the kids?
Well, it potentially can, but let's talk a little bit more about this. So courts determine parental responsibility and time sharing according to the best interest of the child. Okay. And the purpose is to protect the child, not to punish a parent for unrelated adult misconduct. So the key question here is whether the conduct that this parent has, does it demonstrate something relevant to parenting, like poor judgment affecting the child, dishonesty with the court, interference with the other parent's relationship with the child, a risk to the child or the other parent? So, you know, the courts consider each parent's moral fitness and mental and physical health and a number of other things in terms of time sharing. So the court is going to want to look at, is there a connection between this misconduct and the ability to effectively have time sharing with the child? If it only affected financial litigation matters, it shouldn't result in reduced time sharing. But any conduct that demonstrates obsession, coercive control, and inability to obey court orders could affect the court's assessment of parental fitness and the ability to exercise shared parental responsibility.
Anthony, for people who want to get in touch with you, how do they do that?
Would love to talk to anyone who needs my help. They can reach me at my website. That's anthonydiazlaw.com. You can email me at anthony@anthonydiazlaw.com. And you can also reach me by phone, 407-212-7807.
Anthony, thank you so much for joining us. And when we come back, we're going to look at two news anchors who went from delivering the news to becoming the story in their high-profile divorce. Don't go anywhere. We will be right back.
Anthony Diaz, known as the Peacemaker, is not your typical divorce attorney. Anthony is a Florida-based family law and collaborative divorce attorney, certified Supreme Court national mediator, inspirational speaker, author, and coach who is on a mission to transform the divorce narrative. With over two decades of experience as a former CPA, assistant state attorney, and conflict resolution expert, Anthony Diaz is uniquely qualified to help clients navigate divorce while avoiding the emotional courtroom drama and expensive litigation. He is passionate about resolving conflict and co-creating lasting, peaceful solutions. As a trusted and featured guest on the Divorce Hour and other national radio and television shows, Anthony brings clarity, warmth, and wisdom to every conversation, and his growing online following shows just how deeply his message resonates. As a special gift for our listeners, Anthony is offering a complimentary ebook to support you and your journey. Visit anthonydiazlaw.com/subscribe to claim yours. To schedule your consultation, mediation, or interview, email anthony@anthonydiazlaw.com. That's anthony@anthonydiazlaw.com or call 407-212-7807. That's 407-212-7807 or learn more at anthonydiazlaw.com, anthonydiazlaw.com.
According to Psychology Today, about 1-6% of the general population here in the United States has a diagnosable narcissistic personality disorder, which means approximately 3-20 million people here in the United States have an inflated sense of self-importance, a need for constant admiration, a lack of empathy for others. And you know what? They can just be mean. If you're married to someone who fits this description, chances are you often find yourself walking on eggshells because you never know what they're going to say. And if you decide you want out of the marriage, hold on tight, because they're going to make it their business to wear you down, make your life difficult, and blame you for everything. That's why you need a trained licensed and reputable expert such as Dr. Deborah Wilder on your team. Dr. Wilder is a licensed psychologist, relationship and divorce specialist, certified narcissistic abuse treatment clinician, parenting coordinator, divorce counselor, and divorce mediator. Dr. Wilder, welcome.
Thank you. It's very nice to be here.
Very nice to have you. And you know, we hear the word narcissist thrown around all the time, but what specific behaviors or patterns should someone look for to determine whether or not they are dealing with a narcissist or rather just somebody who's being difficult?
The word pattern that you just said, that's the key. Narcissists behave in patterns versus like an episode or a situation. Someone can be a jerk or just mean, but it's not always consistent. If you're in a relationship with a narcissist, you're going to see certain things over and over again, experience certain things over and over again, like gaslighting, which is when the narcissist tries to make you doubt your own reality. The ultimate purpose of, or the goal of a narcissist in a relationship is really to gain power and to try to make you feel like you are not in touch with reality. They use devaluation. There are cycles of abuse. They blame shift. There's something called intermittent reinforcement, which is a way that you get captured into this cycle of abuse where they're nice sometimes, they're great sometimes, they're awful sometimes, but then they cycle back to getting sort of normal and nice again. And it's sort of like being addicted to a drug, because you get that high when they're nice, and you know your body does all sorts of things. So another thing to consider when you're in a relationship with a narcissist is sometimes, or oftentimes, your body knows things before your mind does. And if you're constantly in a state of fight or flight, that tells you something. If you're constantly walking on eggshells, or you're not trusting yourself anymore, or you have to ask the other person or ask other people, did this really happen? Or, you know, you don't trust yourself anymore. When your body is in that state of fight or flight consistently and constantly, that is a sign that you are in a very abusive relationship. Whether or not that person is actually a narcissist or just has narcissistic traits, it's the kind of slow, insidious, at least slow in the beginning, and then it happens more and more over time, but it's insidious, breaking down your own sense of reality and your own sense of self-worth as well.
Are narcissists typically drawn or latch on to a particular type of person?
Yes, and a lot of the folks I work with, in fact, most of them think sometimes that, well, you know, why did I stay? Why am I in this? Am I stupid? Am I weak? But in fact, the opposite is true. Narcissists will be drawn to people who are strong, people who have empathy, people who are loyal, who have a good work ethic, and they see the best in others, because narcissists pick people who make them look good. They're the supply. They're the great supply, because narcissists need to feel important. They need to feel special. They need to have a sense of power. And so the people they choose have great qualities, but they break them down and they wear them down over time, to the point where sometimes these people don't recognize themselves anymore, and they think they're stupid or they think they're weak, when in fact it really, really is the opposite.
If someone recognizes that that their relationship is emotionally abusive and unhealthy, why can it be difficult leaving, especially if the relationship is a marriage they want to dissolve?
We get back to that intermittent reinforcement, where you have good, it's not all bad. In these relationships, never is it 100% awful. So people hold on to hope. And again, these folks are loyal. They made a pledge. Maybe they're scared to leave. They don't feel comfortable or confident enough in what may happen. They may have children with this person. They may be scared that if they get a divorce, you know, they don't want to leave their children with this person alone. All sorts of reasons. They've invested a lot of time. They fear what may happen afterward, and grief. You know, they've tried to build a life. They've been a good partner. I think ultimately it's about hope, hoping that this person will change, and the body, there's something called a trauma bond, and that is when the intermittent highs and lows create an attachment. Again, that sort of mimics the addiction. And it's important to understand that these kinds of, it's a full body experience. It's not logical. It is a full body experience. When you're in a relationship with someone like this, it does affect you mentally, emotionally, physically, chemically, neurologically, hormonally, all of this. And so, someone sometimes can get used to being in fight or flight all the time. It's just the way life ends up being. So it's a slow, gradual breakdown of a person's sense of self and sense of reality. So sometimes they don't even really recognize themselves anymore. So why is it so hard to leave? Usually it's because of the trauma bond and the hope that things will, you know, we'll circle back to the positive. It's a very strong, and it's irrational. It really is. So when I'm working with folks who are coming out of a relationship like this, it takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of time to learn how to be regulated again and to learn how to feel safe again and to learn how to not only trust other people but trust yourself. So it's a very, very painful relationship and getting out of it. And another thing, too, people are afraid what happens when they go through divorce from someone like this, because the divorce is just as bad often, if not worse, because they can ramp things up. It just becomes legal abuse. So it's definitely a battle, but because it's a full body experience, it's not just a rational thing. You know, one might think, well, you know you're being hurt. You know this person's doing this to you. Why don't you just leave? But it really is a full body experience, which makes it a lot harder.
So what are the first steps towards becoming emotionally stable or protecting your mental well-being during a divorce from a person who is a narcissist?
First of all, trying to get out of it. You know, once someone is away from that toxic environment, it really does open the door to becoming more emotionally regulated. And there are certain things that people can do to help with that. There are certain exercises, certain things that they can do to help them get out of that fight or flight state. And one of the things is to become as knowledgeable as you can about the patterns that you've experienced, to be able to predict what may be coming up next. So when I work with women, I work with men too, but I tend to work mostly with women in this area. We work on understanding the big picture. What is it that you've gone through? What did it feel like? What were the behaviors? What were the patterns? And we talk about what to expect going into the divorce, because you've got to be prepared. These folks are masters at manipulation, and they still want the control, and they're still mean, and they're still wanting to punish and do whatever they can. So being prepared, being knowledgeable, and having support around you can make all the difference in the world.
Talk to me about recovery. How does somebody heal from going through a divorce with a narcissist and not repeating the same patterns when they're ready to maybe get back out there and meet somebody new?
Grieving is important. Recognizing that what you've been through was not what you had dreamed about, but recognizing that what you were in was a toxic, traumatic relationship, and learning to trust yourself again, surrounding yourself with people who are supportive, rebuilding your identity, maybe getting back in touch with things that you really used to enjoy or things that you might need to build from scratch, rebuilding your identity. And it's really important to work with people who understand what you're going through and who can help you. But I also encourage people to feel hopeful, because there is life after this, and it's often so much better. So much better. What I tell people I work with all the time is you're not going to recognize yourself once you sort of get on the other side of the hill. It's an amazing transformation that these folks go through. So there is a lot of hope on the other end of this.
And you also offer an online course to help people get there. Tell us quickly about that.
Yes, yeah, so I developed, it's called the Restore Method, and it's sort of like a GPS that helps. It's a comprehensive program tying the psychological, the legal, the financial stuff, the emotional, the physical, everything about divorce, tying it all together again, sort of like a GPS, where you get really coverage. Because what I tell folks is I've been in every room they're about to enter. So they're not doing this alone, but it offers the kind of guidance, advice, support, and information that they need to really have the best chances of not only surviving this, but thriving throughout the divorce as well as afterward.
Great advice. Dr. Walder, for people who want to learn more and get in touch with you, how do they do that?
They can, probably the easiest way is just to go to my website, Dr. Deborah Wilder, DrDeborahWilder.com. And you can, there's a contact section, a form, just fill it out and get, you know, send me a message and I will reach out as soon as I can afterward.
Thank you so much for joining us. And when we come back, we're going to tell you about an everyday activity that helps you get in shape, and I mean great shape. Lower your blood pressure, keep your heart healthy, and get this one, you can even do it for free. Don't go anywhere.
Dr. Deborah Wilder is a leading expert on high conflict and emotionally abusive divorce. She's a licensed psychologist, a certified narcissistic abuse treatment clinician, divorce mediator, and a divorce and relationship specialist with nearly 4 decades in the mental health field. Deborah specializes in helping women divorcing narcissists and emotional abusers, guiding clients through the financial, legal, and psychological chaos that comes with a high conflict split. Deborah's signature program, The Restore Method, is a clinically built, trauma-informed, step-by-step system that guides women through every stage of a toxic or coercive controlled divorce. It's designed for those who may not be able to work with her directly, giving them the tools, strategies, and emotional grounding they need to stay safe, stay organized, and stay strong. Deborah also offers a free webinar for anyone who wants to understand the process before taking the next step. Dr. Wilder is SciPact authorized to work with clients across 43 states, a contributing author of Divorce Decoded, and co-host of Divorce and Relationships Decoded on YouTube. For anyone facing a high-conflict divorce, Deborah is one of the most trusted voices in the field. Contact Deborah by email at dscw@drdeborahwilder.com or through her website, drdeborahwilder.com. That's drdeborahwilder.com.
Former CBS anchor Josh Elliott and local WABC TV anchor Liz Cho are at the center of a contentious divorce battle that has made headlines across the New York tri-state area. Josh filed for divorce on June 20th of 2025, nearly a decade after marriage. Now, the couple are familiar faces on the New York social scene and on many red carpets. But now their split is resulting in them becoming the news instead of them delivering the news. According to court filings, the divorce escalated into disputes over property allegedly being removed from their Connecticut home, missing jewelry, financial records, and demands for private communications. Now, the couple do not have any children together, but each does have a kid from a previous marriage. So what happens when a divorce begins privately and then that battle becomes played out in the media? Well, joining us to explain is Darrell Wyman, the senior managing attorney at the Austin, Texas law firm of Gravis Law, a national law firm with offices in 10 states. Darrell is a trained litigator, mediator, author, and public speaker. Darrell, welcome.
Thanks, Alyssa. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. And let's start with the news that that is the most current. It's with a protective order that Liz's team is requesting from a Connecticut court. Now, again, this is in Connecticut. You are in Texas and you do not know these people. But Liz's counsel wants to prevent her from being deposed by Josh's lawyers, and they object to certain discovery requests that Josh's team is seeking. Now, again, even though this case is taking place in Connecticut and you practice in Texas, when a high conflict matter such as theirs starts to unfold, under what circumstances will a judge grant a protective order such as the one described in their situation?
So first I want to be clear that this is not a protective order for domestic violence. This is a protective order for discovery. So during a divorce, people are allowed to discover information from the other side, and sometimes they don't want to have to comply with the discovery requests. In this particular case, Josh's counsel wanted to depose, do a deposition of Liz. They sent out a notice for the deposition, and Liz's counsel wasn't available that day, and so they filed a request for protective order from having to participate in the deposition on that particular day. Not that they were not going to participate, they just needed it rescheduled, and they were asking the court to get involved and make sure they were not sanctioned for not appearing on that particular day. There were also other documents that were requested, things like emails and other text messages with potential, I guess, paramours, you know, new relationships. And so they were asking for protection from having to provide those documents. It's fairly common to have requests for protective orders in divorce cases. People are asking for a whole lot of information the other side doesn't want to reveal. Sometimes they lose on their request and they have to reveal it anyway. And sometimes the other side is overreaching, and so the request for protective order is granted.
Yeah, I want to get back to those emails. If every state is identified or considered a no-fault state, isn't estranged spouses' romantic history or emails they exchanged with somebody, like a potential new partner, relevant in a divorce?
So even though it's a no-fault state, meaning you can get a divorce without there being any fault, fault is still considered in terms of an equitable division of the estate. So they do take into account people's behavior during the marriage, in determining, is this going to be a 50-50 split, a 60-40 split, you know, how, what kind of bad behavior does the court need to consider? Was there adultery? Was there cruel treatment or domestic violence? So even though the divorce can be granted for no fault, the fault in the breakup of the marriage can still be considered as a factor in making an equitable division of the estate.
So, you know, I want to go back to these emails because Liz's team is reportedly seeking to look at, like, you know, Josh's communications because they want to see anything related to his search for employment since Josh is allegedly not working. Why would information about a spouse's job search matter in a divorce case?
Well, I would assume in this case, since there are no children between them, that this is regarding spousal support. So if he is capable of making a certain wage, then they want to base spousal support on that. So I don't know in this particular case who's requesting spousal support from the other, and it could be that Josh is asking for spousal support from Liz if she's working and he's not. So they may want to see how hard is he actually looking for a new job. Or it could be the other way around, that he makes way more than she does when he is working. So they want to see, again, you know, where is he applying for jobs and, you know, what is his wage likely to be. If there were children involved, then clearly they would want to know about all of this for child support purposes. But in this case, it would probably only be spousal support purposes.
So if a person is unemployed, and I'll say Texas, where you are based, they have to show and prove to the court that they are looking for a job. And if so, how do they do that?
Well, they need to show, you know, they're going to show a copy of the resume, and they'll be asked, you know, where have you sent this resume? How hard are you looking? You know, depending on what industry they're in, you know, are you networking or are you posting it on the various, you know, websites, Glassdoor or on LinkedIn, or, you know, how are you looking for a job? Where are you looking for a job? What type of job are you expecting to get? You know, what are the prospects look like, and about how much do you think you will be making when you do get a job?
According to the New York Post, there was a $500,000 transfer from the couple's joint account to Liz's teenage daughter from a previous marriage after Josh filed for a divorce. When two sides are in the middle of dissolving a marriage, can either spouse withdraw money out of a joint account, or can that create a serious legal problem?
Well, during a divorce, the couple is always allowed to spend money for reasonable living expenses and reasonable attorney's fees. If it looks like a fraudulent transfer, like $500,000 transferred to a child's account, a child who's not one of their children together, then that's going to look like a fraudulent transfer. If that's something that they were doing, like maybe they were gifting to their children every year, well, then it's not a big deal. But that seems unlikely with such a big transfer. So, and there are people who panic, you know. They get served with divorce papers, or they know a divorce is coming, and they think, I need to protect, you know, my money, and they send it to their mother, their brother, their whatever. They send it to somebody else's account. That is considered a fraudulent transfer, and so it needs to come back into the community. Now, if they're afraid, they don't trust the other spouse, which, of course, during a divorce, people don't trust each other. They can put it into an account that's solely in their name, but it has to stay within the marriage, within the community. So it has to be within one of the spouse's names or in a joint account, but it can't go to a third party.
Let's talk about the marital residence. Liz claims Josh allegedly took furniture, jewelry, and the couple's two dogs from their Connecticut home. When one spouse moves out during a divorce, are they legally allowed to take any belongings with them? And if someone is concerned that someone is going to remove items, do they need a court order to ensure that does not happen?
So, I mean, when you're setting up a new residence, as long as you're not taking things that the other person owned prior to marriage, or, you know, are not inherited things, you can take a reasonable portion of the household items. I mean, they're going to have to set up a second home, so they shouldn't have to go buy second everything. You know, so if there's a spare bedroom set, they should take that. If there's an extra couch, you know, some of the dishes, some of the linens, things like that, it's perfectly reasonable to take those things to set up a new residence. When it comes to the dogs, the court's going to look at, like, who's taking care of the dogs, whose dogs are they. I think in this case, Josh was saying, well, I'm always the one who took care of them, and she was traveling and leaving them home alone. So sounds reasonable that he took them to take care of them. It doesn't mean he's going to necessarily be awarded them in the long run, but it does, you know, who's going to have actual possession of the dogs during the divorce. When it comes to the allegations of jewelry, she's claiming that he took a couple of expensive pieces of jewelry. That's going to be really hard to prove, unless she has some kind of video that he actually took it, because he says, I don't know what you're talking about, I didn't take it. She says, yes, you did. And, you know, the court's not going to know either way. Did he actually take it, or is she making up the allegation? Maybe she lost it. Who knows? And so a lot of times that does not get resolved in a divorce. Sometimes we'll include it in the decree that if you happen to find these items in your stuff when you're unpacking, then give it back to her. But, you know, it's very hard to prove.
Connecticut follows equitable distribution, what doesn't necessarily mean 50-50, but what's fair according to the law. And according to multiple reports, both Josh and Liz want the division of assets to be equitable. Is that possible in a high conflict situation such as theirs that is now in court?
So an equitable distribution just means what is fair. It doesn't mean 50-50, and that's across the board in every state. I mean, Texas is a community property state, and it's always going to be a just and right division. It's what's equitable, what's fair, and it's what's fair according to the judge, not what's according to the two of them. Because honestly, if they could figure out what was fair, they might not be getting divorced. They both want what's fair, and they don't define fair the same way. So equitable distribution just means that the judge is going to take into account, you know, a lot of different factors. Was there any fault or bad behavior during the marriage? You know, how was money spent? Is there any fraudulent transfers? Does anybody have any, you know, significant separate property? Is one person capable of making way more than the other? They'll look at the age and the health of the spouses, expected inheritance. Like, there's a lot of factors that a judge can look at to decide what is equitable or fair.
So interesting. Dow, for people who want to learn more and get in touch with you, how do they do that?
Well, they can still go through my website, WeinmanFamilyLaw.com, or they can call my office, 512-472-4040.
Dow, thank you so much for joining us. And when we come back, we're going to tell you a great way to get in shape and you don't have to join a gym.
Daryl G. Wyman is the senior managing attorney of the Austin office of Gravis Law, a fast-growing national firm practicing in over 10 states. As the founding partner of Wyman & Associates, Daryl brings decades of respected family law experience to Gravis Law's expanding national team. Daryl's practice covers prenuptial and postnuptial agreements, cohabitation agreements, divorce, child custody, child support, parental relocations, and same-sex family matters, all with the focus on helping clients transition to a stronger, more confident future. Daryl believes divorce isn't a failure. It's an opportunity to rebuild your life with clarity and purpose. Daryl's lived divorce from every angle as a child, a second wife, a stepmother, and a mother who's gone through it herself. That perspective inspired the Divorce Resort Process, a unique approach that resolves your entire divorce in just 72 hours, eliminating months of paperwork, repeated court appearances, and overwhelming legal fees. Learn more at WeinmanFamilyLaw.com. That's W-E-I-N-M-A-N FamilyLaw.com or call 512-472-4040. That's 512-472-4040.
Welcome back to the Divorce Hour. Here on the show, we love sharing simple, practical things you could do, many of them for free or at very little cost to take better care of yourself. And when you're going through a divorce, your mental, emotional, and physical health must be a priority because when you feel better physically, emotionally, and mentally, you think more clearly, you make better decisions, you have more energy, you reduce your stress level, and you become more confident. And let's be honest, divorce can be an off-the-charts stressful event and take a toll on your self-esteem. According to Yale Health, stress can make your heart work harder, increase blood pressure, your heart rate, and cause inflammation. Over time, ongoing stress can cause a person to develop cardiovascular problems, and no one wants that. But what if I told you something you probably do every day, maybe even several times a day, could be good for your heart? Alleviate a lot of those problems I just mentioned, and participating won't cost you a penny. You game? Well, start by climbing the stairs. Yes, the stairs. The ones at your house, the office, the mall, the park, wherever you can find them. Research published in the American Journal of Cardiovascular Drugs looked at adults between the ages of 35 and 84 and found that stair climbing was associated with a 39% lower risk of cardiovascular death and 24% lower risk of death from any cause. Now, that doesn't mean you need to suddenly become a stair climbing champion, but stair climbing is an intense form of physical activity because you're getting the heart rate up, you're working against gravity. It builds your lower body strength and gives you an energy boost. And here's another interesting discovery. Previous research suggests that climbing approximately 6 flights or maybe roughly 60 steps already gives you an advantage. Now, you don't need to necessarily go to an expensive gym or a fancy workout studio to reap the benefits of climbing stairs. You can, again, do it right in your own home. But before you go walking up and down the nearest staircase, you should consult with your physician or healthcare provider to make sure that they give you clearance to take part in this activity, which I do all the time in my home. I'm always going up and down with laundry or stuff for the kids, and I always play great music. And to me, it becomes something really fun to do. That's our show for today. Thank you for joining us. Until next time.